One of the main areas of contamination in cigarettes is the solvents utilized to drive the flavoring chemicals and the aroma chemicals and the smoker satisfaction chemicals into the cellulose of the synthetic smoking material. They have to carry those chemicals into this alpha cellulose, which is recycled municipal waste, recycled forest industry product waste, that kind of stuff. It's basic cellulose. So they have to use solvents to carry these flavoring chemicals and so forth into the alpha cellulose. They use things like benzene, toluene, and cyclohexane. They also use one of the more common solvents, and I have copies of the patents for the utilization of this, is phosgene.
That's nerve gas.
That's exactly right. It's a very effective solvent as well. And residues of it remain in the alpha cellulose. They could take a cigarette, cut it apart, and look at those little golden curls under magnification, and you'll see that they're not parts of leaves. There's no veins in them, you know. But what you can see is you can see they're composed of little fine particles. That's ground up roots and stems. Those tobacco plants in the third world where they were originally raised were sprayed with all kinds of pesticides. 350,000 people a year are dying of smoking cigarettes. We've got untold numbers of babies being destroyed from birth by cigarettes. We've got tremendous social and economic costs, the equivalent of 3 747s crashing a day, you know, and it's an industry that is in effect been given license by the government to produce a product that's doing this.
If you think the cigarettes are bad for you, well, they're really much, much worse, as we find out by interviewing writer and researcher Bill Drake right now on Alternative Views. Well, we want all you folks to light up your cigarettes, your regular cigarettes. Well, your filter cigarettes would be even better, because we want you to enjoy that cigarette, because it might be your last one after you hear what we're going to be talking about on Alternative Views, because Bill Drake is with us. He's a writer and researcher, and he's found out things about what is in cigarettes that I haven't heard before. And if you thought cigarettes were bad before, wait till you hear what we have for you tonight. Well, before we talk to Bill Drake, here are some news stories.
The story of the U.S. and the CIA being involved in drug traffic, among other nefarious activities, from, well, not just, well, all over the world, although they perhaps got their first taste of it back in the Golden Triangle area of Southeast Asia. The Christic Institute has been talking about this, and there have been some government investigations themselves into it. But here we have right-wing person talking about it. You remember James Bo Gritz, that swashbuckling Ollie North clone who, by gosh, he was going to go out in Southeast Asia, and he was going to find all those MIAs and kick-ass out there. And we thought, oh, gosh, is he doing some nefarious work for the CIA or just WhatsApp or just another right-wing crazy thing? Well, he's back. He didn't find any MIAs, but he did find that the U.S. government is a major factor in the drugs produced and in the distribution of it in the Golden Triangle area of Southeast Asia, and Bo Gritz is angry about it. So maybe he was on the up and up after all. Now, he brought this information, including a videotape of people who are involved in it there. he brought this information back to Congress, and the congressional committee, chaired by Representative Lawrence Smith, a Democrat of Florida, just blew him off and wouldn't even let him distribute a copy of his videotapes to the rest of the people on the subcommittee. And he tried to give this information to the networks. In fact, he did distribute the videotapes to the networks and to CNN, but nothing has happened in that regard either. So what the contact that Bogritz had in Southeast Asia is General Khun Sa, an Asian warlord who has actually been one of the major drug traffickers himself. But he has accused the U.S. government and has of doing this and being in collusion with this. And he says that he would like to stop the drug traffic in his country, but the U.S. wouldn't let him. When Gritz brought this information back to the White House, he said, forget it. So when you see some of the people, the names that Bo Gritz talks about as being involved, it's the same folks, Albert Hakim, Richard Armitage, people who have been on the in the Contergate hearings. You've got some more information on them, don't you, Doug?
Yes. This tape that Bo Gritz had from the warlord from Laos who had been involved in the drug program pointed to this Richard Armitage as one of the participants in this network. This is a shock because of all the people that were involved in Contragate, he's in the highest government position of anyone. Richard Armitage is an assistant secretary of state who directs the Defense Department policy towards the third world, who's the person in charge of the Reagan Doctrine, which is stopping communism. He's in charge of all the military operations that the Reagan administration take place all over the world. He is involved in the covert operations. He's involved in military assistance programs. And he was, of course, very involved with Oliver North in the Contragate scandals. Yet nothing has come out on this character and his background. So in these times, went into his whole story and shows him deeply involved with all the members of the secret team who have been involved in drug running, political assassinations, business deals, inside and outside of the government for over 10 or 15 years. In these Times reports that after a stint in the Navy in what the Pentagon calls counterintelligence ambush teams, which is a code word for assassination units, suddenly Richard Armitage appears in Saigon in 1973 as a civilian employee, a consultant to the South Vietnamese Navy. What he was really doing, according to In These Times, was handling the secret team's drug funds. At this time in Laos, Richard Secord was allegedly running a covert war for the CIA, and part of that war involved doing deals with some of the local drug lords and taking their drugs out of the country and using the profits from the sale of these drugs to support these right-wing covert operations. Then, after doing this work for a couple of years, in 1974, Armitage was assigned to work for the Pentagon and then ended up in Iran as a arms dealer and as a close consultant to the Shah of Iran, in which he was associated also with Richard Secord, who was also active in Iran at that time. In 1976, once again as a private citizen, Armitage founded a dummy corporation in Bangkok, allegedly to launder drug profits that were controlled by the CIA people like Theodore Shockley and Ray Klinus, who had begun working with Secord in Laos in these illegal drug operations. Next, Armitage founded the Far East Trading Company that was also allegedly involved in arms sales, drug running, and other such agencies. And then in the late 1970s, Armitage became an administrative assistant to Robert Doyle, the senator from Kansas, who wants to run for president.
Doyle, Robert Doyle.
Right. And then served as a foreign policy advisor to Reagan in his election campaign in 1980, and after Reagan won, He has been a high official in the Defense Department and has worked also closely with Frank Carlucci. And when all of these charges were leveled against Armitage, Carlucci stepped in to defend him, refused to subject him to lie detector tests, just as earlier Carlucci had protected Richard Secord when he was accused of being involved with illegal arms and drug sales. And Carlucci has sort of served as the front, the cover, for these guys. And to this day, Armitage is one of the top Pentagon officials who's carrying out major functions in the Reagan administration, directing foreign policy. And although all these stories have been brought to the media, none of them have surfaced. Oh. Only in these times, in the spotlight, and some other publications have come out with this.
Well, on this Bo Gritz story, Gritz says that he continued talking in this interview with Khun Sa, who was a general and a drug lord himself in Burma, who says he wants to try to eliminate opium in his country. But here's how he said, see, now they went down to Bangkok and talked with Colonel Denny Lane of the American Embassy and the Drug Enforcement Administration office there. It's very interesting how in other stories you've read too, the Drug Enforcement Administration and the CIA are there just side by side right down the office where all these things go on. But Khun Sa said that the records he kept, this is also on the videotape, from 1965 to 1975, the CIA agent was Theodore Shackley there, and Shackley was involved in drug smuggling at the time. And Shackley used a civilian named, got this, Santo Traficante, who organized and trafficked the drugs for him back in the United States. Of course, he's a famous mafioso. Now, the Khun Sa also read from the records that he'd been keeping all these years that Richard Armitage financed the smuggling of drugs while in Vietnam, and he was one of the very prominent figures in Bangkok in drugs, too, from 1975 to 1979. And after leaving that post and while still in Bangkok, he established that Far East Trading Company, and the drug operation continued. Now, as we said, this information has been turned over to Congress and to the networks, but you don't hear about it
in the mass media.
Yeah.
Well, there's an article in the Covert Action Information Bulletin about the media's double standards when they deal with the question of who deals drugs. Is it the Sandinistas? Is it the Contras? Which groups have been using the sale of drugs to support their political activities? The Covert Action Information Bulletin reports that in 1984, in July, Reagan made his first accusations that the Sandinista administration in Nicaragua was involved in drug running, and this story was dutifully taken up by the Mooney newspaper in Washington, the Washington Times, that published a story linking, quote, important members of the Marxist government in Nicaragua with drug trafficking. Shortly thereafter, relying on the same unnamed sources, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and NBC TV started to play up the alleged stories of the connection between the Nicaraguan government and international drug sales. And by March of 1986, Reagan was emboldened to go on national TV and declare in a speech, "I know that all American presidents who are concerned about the drug problem will be enraged to hear that high-ranking members of the Nicaraguan government are deeply involved in drug trafficking." At the appropriate moment, this television screen then showed a picture of a blurred black-and-white photograph in which allegedly a plane was loading up cocaine in Managua, being loaded up by Nicaraguan officials for delivery to the United States. And Reagan commented, "There is obviously no crime the Sandinistas do not recoil from. This is a lawless regime." Soon after, it was reported in the alternative press, but not by the mainstream press, that this picture came from Barry Seal, who was a convicted drug smuggler who had turned government witness against cocaine dealers from Colombia for the Reagan administration and had supplied what is alleged to be a doctored up photograph as the only evidence to link the Sandinista regime to drug traffic. And no one has been able to come up with any evidence that the Sandinistas have been involved in drug traffic. Likewise, there was a story that Robert Vesco and the Cubans, Fidel Castro, were involved in drug smuggling to try to destroy the U.S. from within, but no evidence was provided. Although, again, the mainstream media has devoted a lot of time, both in the print media like Time Magazine, Newsweek, Washington Post, New York Times, and in the television media, to allege that the Sandinistas or the Cubans were involved in drug running.
Now, there was that court case that, as you said, was held, and the judge absolutely found nothing to support the government's charges on this. And the Columbia Journalism Review made a story on it, and they observed what was printed in the press. Like you said, nothing.
Right.
Wasn't at all.
And the same Columbia Journalism Review did a study of the coverage of the allegations that the Contras were involved in running drugs, and shows that hardly any attention was given to that throughout 1985 and 1986, despite quite a few stories that had been published or that had been researched by AP newspaper reporters that simply didn't get play in the national media, even though two reporters had filed several stories alleging Contra drug running in 1985. They rarely, if ever, got on to the wire services.
Now, they had trouble even getting their information onto AP to start out with.
Even
their editors
on,
there.
Right. And it wasn't until December of 1986 that the stories first appeared documenting this elaborate Contra arms and drug ring, and it first appeared in These Times. And although it was picked up by The Nation, The Village Voice, Mother Jones, and many other of the left-wing and the liberal news magazines, it's rarely appeared on mainstream television. CBS has had two outstanding reports on their news journal, West 57th Street, but there's been very little coverage on their nightly news, and the other networks have completely neglected the story of the allegations concerning Contra drug running, so they were very eager to pick up on the story that the Sandinistas were running drugs, which had much less evidence and credibility than this other story. So this shows a real double standard when the media comes to covering this drug issue.
There's one thing that the media do not cover fairly. It strikes against media corporations themselves. As illustrated by a portion of a program, Labor Beat, which is a Chicago cable access TV program.
Go. Right. This is the Freedom Center on Grand Street at the back of the Tribune building. Time now is about 7:30. At 8 o'clock, there's going to be a large rally. People are starting to arrive from different parts of the city.
Let's keep it on. Unity.
Okay. This affects all of us. It's part of our life, part of America.
Well, things don't look too good either, do they?
All morning long, trucks have been coming in and out. Earlier this morning, there was approximately 25 people arrested after trying to block trucks, some broken windows, some struggle.
Shut down the trip! 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 Shut down the trip!
What time did you get here?
Well, I've got here this morning at 5 o'clock, and we went to, from our strike headquarters, we all came down here to in solidarity together. We're trying to hope that the Tribune would finally start negotiating in good faith. We haven't had a meeting in about 3 weeks. They refuse to bargain in good faith. It has nothing to do with money. It's just our dignity, and that's all it is. And the Tribune just don't want to listen.
There's two more trip trucks that are not going to get in today.
If we let them break one union, that's the start of it. President Reagan done it already with the over at O'Hare Airport, okay? So, you know, once you give in, it's just one thing after another, okay? I mean, we're dealing with our livelihoods here, okay? This is America, okay? I mean, you know, that's it. You have to deal with it, you know? You can't give up on it. You have to be strong and deal with it.
Mailers, too. I'm one of the ones on strike. Everything's been peaceful. It's the way it should be handled. Just a lot of people? Well, you can see I'm a little shabbily dressed. You know, no money in my pocket. Times are tough. What can I tell you? Scabbed, you know. Things don't look too good either, do they? Huh? They look better after today, though.
Yeah.
Nice turnout.
I'm Donna Meyer. I'm the recording secretary for Local 1427. We're on the Commonwealth Edison property. We're here today to support the locals. I think there's too many fat cats that have forgotten what unionism is all about, and we're here to support them and say we're together.
How's the strike affecting your life?
This strike?
Yeah.
I prevented or stopped and encouraged my family and friends to quit buying the Tribune. This affects all of us. It's part of our life, part of America.
This is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I support the Tribune people. I think the Trip, it's no longer the world's greatest newspaper, it's the world's greediest newspaper. That's what they are.
Now this man interview.
Right. I think they should have had this back in August sometime.
Yeah.
This is beautiful, you know. I just like to say that, hey, let's keep it on. Unity.
Okay, all right.
Keep it going.
That's
thank
the
you.
Word. Us united together.
See, the general public don't understand what unions do, especially steelworkers. You know, I'm a steelworker, but we fight for social, you know, issues, you know, in Congress and all that, you know. And the public don't understand. They think, well, everything is high because of unions. You know, we're only about 20% of the population.
Whatever happens here, man, it happens throughout all unions. And I wish all unions get together and support everybody when there's come times like this.
Shut down the trip! Shut down the trip! Shut down the trip! Shut down the trip! Shut down the trip!
Coming down Grand Avenue, Local 144 International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and 3,000 of your friends. Let's greet them. Business Manager Timothy Brisnick.
Now let's turn our attention to cigarettes and the horrible, horrible things that are inside cigarettes that most of us are not aware of, as we interview author and researcher Bill Drake.
Bill, we're very pleased to have you on Alternative Views tonight, and I think we're going to have an opportunity to tell our audience all the things that they wanted to know but were afraid to ask about smoking, cigarettes, the tobacco industry, because you've been researching these topics for years and have come up with all sorts of new information that's generally not known to the public. So let's begin by telling some of those people that are puffing out in the audience what are in those weeds that they are getting such pleasure from.
Well, they are getting a lot of pleasure out of their cigarettes. In fact, each person who has a favorite brand is getting his own specific brand of pleasure. For one thing, because there's a whole, each brand has a patented set of chemicals in it, which generically in the industry are known as smoker satisfaction chemicals. And they are specifically designed to be mildly physiologically addictive, as well as to be to acclimatize the taste of the smoker to the particular taste of the brand. It's the reason why if a smoker of brand A runs out of brand A and bums brand B off a friend, that might last and for a little while, but as soon as that smoker of brand A can get to the machine he'll go ahead and buy brand A again. He's addicted to it.
You know, I've talked to people since we talked several weeks ago. I've just checked, you know, smokers, I say, do you ever try any other cigarettes? And he said, you know, I try this other cigarettes, but they sure don't taste good. I like my own brand.
Exactly.
I guess
exactly.
So.
And that's just one of
them. What is it that they're addicted to? Is it the tobacco or these specific chemicals?
Well, there's a whole set of answers to your question, unfortunately, and I'll try to keep it short. For one thing, certainly they're addicted to nicotine. Nicotine is a component of cigarettes. Mostly nowadays, the nicotine that's in there is not in there as a result of being on a natural tobacco leaf. It's in there because the manufacturers have incorporated it as an ingredient in the synthetic smoking materials that most cigarettes are made out of now. Then, of course, there's a form of addiction that's generally not discussed with cigarettes, but it's a real factor, and that is that cigarettes contain so many extremely toxic ingredients that are put in there as a result of manufacturing decisions. They're not in any natural tobacco that may have somehow found its way into the cigarette. So there's a toxic addiction. When you take a small amount of a highly toxic substance into your body on a chronic, sublethal basis, your body develops an addiction to it. You stop ingesting that toxic chemical, and your body will go through withdrawal. It's not a withdrawal pleasure.
What are some of these things that they put in?
Well, for instance, one of the main areas of contamination in cigarettes is the solvents utilized to drive the flavoring chemicals and the aroma chemicals and the smoker satisfaction chemicals into the cellulose of the synthetic smoking material. They have to carry those chemicals into this alpha cellulose, which is recycled municipal waste, recycled forest industry product waste, that kind of stuff. It's basic cellulose. So they have to use solvents to carry these flavoring chemicals and so forth into the alpha cellulose. They use things like benzene, toluene, and cyclohexane. They also use one of the more common solvents, and I have copies of the patents for the utilization of this, is phosgene.
That's nerve gas.
That's exactly right. It's a very effective solvent as well. And residues of it remain in the alpha cellulose after processing is through. And so when the cigarette is smoked, when this synthetic smoking material is burned, in addition to the release of chemicals that naturally accompany the combustion of organic materials, you get release of such things as phosgene and benzene. And
well, now, benzene, that's a known carcinogen, too.
Precisely, yeah, exactly. One of the main reasons that the cigarette industry, and we need to distinguish between the cigarette industry and the tobacco industry, but one of the main reasons that they are able to say it's never been effectively proven or scientifically proven that cigarettes cause cancer or heart disease and so forth. Well, it actually hasn't ever been scientifically proven. And that's primarily because the cigarettes that are utilized by NIH and all the other testing organizations in conducting their rat skin painting tests and all that sort of thing are especially supplied to them by the tobacco industry. And they're University of Kentucky standard 100-millimeter cigarettes, and they are composed of pure tobacco. There's no synthetic smoking material. There's no benzene. There's none of the processing chemicals utilized in these cigarettes that are smoked by the machines and then painted on the mouse skins and so forth. So there's an elaborate set of reasons why the tobacco industry, or pardon me, the cigarette industry, is still, in the face of common sense, able to maintain this glib, disingenuous attitude of, well, nobody's really proved it.
Well, in fact, there's many different kinds of tobacco and even pesticide residues that get into cigarettes. It's not
exactly
the pure, sweet leaf that you sometimes see in the South, you know, hanging up to dry.
And you see in all the ads.
Right, and you see in all the ads. Tell us a little bit about junk tobacco and
you
the
bet.
Way that pesticide residues get into tobacco and add to the poison here.
Well, in addition to synthetic materials, synthetic smoking materials, which today comprise a large portion of most brands of cigarettes, you have what's called reconstituted sheet, appropriately named. And it's composed of roots and stems and trash, tobacco trash, brought into this country by the cigarette manufacturers, primarily from third world sources, utilized. It's ground up into a fine powder, and it's incorporated along with glues and flavoring chemicals and so forth into a sheet that looks like a piece of plywood or a particle board, which is then shaved in giant mills. And that's, if a person who's smoking cares to, and a lot of people would rather not know which is one of the reasons that perhaps sets are clicking at this very moment. But for those who are listening who care to, take a cigarette, cut it apart, and look at those little golden curls under magnification, and you'll see that they're not parts of leaves. There's no veins in them, you know. But what you can see is you can see they're composed of little fine particles. That's ground up roots and stems. Those tobacco plants in the third world where they were originally raised were sprayed with all kinds of pesticides. I have research that has been done in Europe that indicates that there are dozens of pesticides, many of which are totally banned in this country.
Like
DDT, what? Chlordane, heptachlor, toxaphene, dieldrin, aldrin, andrin, on and on. Endosulfan, a wide range of pesticides that have known fetus-damaging effects. They are chemicals that are specifically designed not to kill bugs, because bugs generally in the tropics now, you can't poison them. They're immune to poisons. So you have to go after them genetically. And these chemicals are designed either to go after the adult bugs to mess up their reproductive systems, or the third level of pesticides being used and getting onto tobacco and getting into the roots and stems and being brought in and made into remanufactured sheet in this country. There are even chemicals designed specifically to produce non-viable insect offspring.
And this works then, its magic, through cigarettes into people then?
We don't know. But I think it's really unlikely that all the damage to fetuses being experienced by smoking mothers is due to carbon monoxide and nicotine.
You think it's these chemicals as well?
Well, I think it's reasonable to assume that if you're ingesting six different chemicals and three of them are known fetus damagers and carcinogens, mm-hmm. and three others you don't know what they are, they may or may not be, I think it makes sense to focus on the things that you know are there. Mm-hmm.
What about filters? Are filters on the cigarettes able to keep some of these poisons and tars and nicotine from entering the body?
In some cases, certain types of filters, yes. The governments of Europe, the governments of the European Economic Community, have for the last 20 years recognized that this is a really severe problem, pesticides in cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And they have extensive regulations in place in Europe. In fact, you cannot bring tobacco into Europe for manufacture into cigarettes that has DDT contamination, that has any endrin on it. Most of the organochlorine pesticides are totally banned in Europe on tobacco products. And as a consequence, any smoker knows. You smoke brand A in the U.S. and you go to Europe and buy brand A at the airport and in the train station or wherever, it tastes very different. And that's because it's made with tobacco, for one thing. Relatively little reconstituted tobacco is present in European cigarettes, simply because they can't get enough uncontaminated material to make the cheap substitute with, so they have to use the real thing.
What about other tobacco products like cigars or snuff and chewing tobacco?
Well, in terms of pesticides, each has its own specific kind of danger. Cigars, for instance, the really good cigars wrapped in real genuine tobacco leaf. Remember, I mentioned before the program that one of the things about tobacco is it's very high in sugar. And insects, of course, are very attracted to plants that are high in sugar and high in protein. Consequently, when you're raising cigar leaf tobacco in the tropics, you have a real, real serious problem with insects biting holes in it, and that makes it unacceptable as wrapper leaf. Even worse, you have a problem with snails and slugs. So there's a wide range of snail and slug killers, which usually incorporate heavy metals, that are utilized on cigar wrapper leaf tobacco. Methamol, if you're familiar with pesticides, is probably the most common and highest level contaminant of cigar leaves. Chewing tobacco, snuff, wet snuff, which a lot of young people are turning to, particularly as an alternative to smoking, is extraordinarily dangerous from the standpoint of oral cavity cancer, primarily because several of the pesticides used in the production of the junk tobacco, basically, the trash tobacco that's used to make this stuff, are very high in things like NDEALA, which is a known oral cavity carcinogen. There is an extreme danger, really, in using this wet snuff. This Sean Marcy case up in Oklahoma that was just lost a few months back. If his mother and his lawyer had had access to this information, they should have tried the case in a whole different area, because the manufacturers are guilty of of knowing that these chemicals are present in cigarettes and tobacco so-called products.
Now, how have you gotten all this information?
A lot of Freedom of Information Act. A lot of just plain reading industry literature. The industry is totally unregulated. They don't have to comply to any federal or state regulations with regard to what they put in their products or what their products are contaminated with. So they chatter back and forth a great deal in their technical papers. I have a computer list sent to me by EPA, and this is a printout of all the tobacco industry studies done on the effects of pesticides in creating off taste. They're very concerned about consumer acceptance problems.
They don't care about the health problems. They're worried about the taste.
Well, they don't study the health problems, because if they did study the health problems, then they could it could be said that they knew about them.
So what does off taste mean?
Oh, if it tastes any different than what the consumer is accustomed to. Each brand has a very specific set of taste buds it goes after, and a very specific set of aromas. In fact, there are specific chemicals in there designed to give you that first aroma that comes out of the pack when you open it. That's a specific chemical in each brand or set of chemicals. Then when you pull the cigarette out and put it in your mouth, there's another set of chemicals that are designed to draw you further into the use of the product. It's a very well thought through product.
Bill, you mentioned that in Europe they had regulation in the tobacco industry against using pesticides on tobacco.
Exactly.
And that the industry is not regulated in the United States.
Precisely.
To oversee any of these things you're talking about that are in cigarettes. Why is this the case? We think of ourselves as a modern, progressive society. How come we're so far behind the rest of the world in regulating the cigarette industry?
That's a good question without an answer that can be given authoritatively, but I can point to a couple of things. The tobacco industry built America. I mean, tobacco money provided the capital for the maintenance and development of the majority of the first colonies, and tobacco as a trade item was extraordinarily important. It earned its producers a vast sums of money that were instrumental in developing the United States, really. It has the, in terms of a corporate product, the tobacco industry has the cigarette industry, has the highest internal rate of return on invested capital of any industry anywhere. I mean, it's just simply number one by a long, long margin. The diversification of the capital that's been earned by the cigarette companies over the last half century has brought them into ownership of just about everything that you can think of on just about any level. They're not into being obvious empire builders, so you don't see organization charts really very often. But inside the tobacco industry, I've pieced together an ownership network of the capital. And it even penetrates a long, long way. For instance, the Mary Babcock Reynolds Foundation is a prime funder of Ralph Nader's Public Citizen Group.
And that's tobacco related?
Reynolds.
Oh, Reynolds, okay.
Yeah, sorry. Should have been more.
And has Ralph never done an expose of the cigarette industry?
Actually, I went through a very interesting back and forth with the editor of Public Citizen. Okay. About a year and a half ago, he wanted to do a sizable expose based on this information.
That's the Nader magazine.
The Nader magazine, right. But when it rose to the level of the editorial board, Dr. Sidney Wolfe, who is their principal medical authority, I was told that his objection to doing the story was, why raise the issue that might lead people to say, well, maybe it isn't the tobacco that's causing all the trouble, maybe it's all these chemicals, and so maybe smoking tobacco would be okay, which is part of my premise, really. I'm not certain that smoking tobacco is that bad for people who want to smoke tobacco.
But it's the cigarette industry. Frank, I might note that we interviewed George Seldes on Alternative Views, who wrote, in fact, that was the first U.S. magazine to explore some of the dangers of tobacco, or rather cigarette smoking. And Seldes said that no other magazine, journal, or newspaper in the United States would publish an article critical of the cigarette industry because of the amount of advertising that went into all of these different media from the cigarette industry that was one of the major, you know, spenders of advertising revenue, along with, I think, alcohol and cars. And so none of these dangerous industries could be investigated simply because whoever did that would lose advertising revenue.
Even more conspiratorial, if you want to see things on that level, which it's often hard not to. The fact is that it's not just cigarette advertising that controls the media. The cigarette companies own alcohol, they own food processing, they own transportation, they own a great deal of media itself, they own food processing companies. So in other words, if a magazine or a piece of print media or electronic media is about to do something that is effectively dangerous to the industry, the advertising pressure can come from all kinds of directions. I mean, Del Monte is owned by R.J. Reynolds. You know, I mean,
it's one of the biggest food conglomerates in the world.
Sure, and how many Del Monte ads are in a magazine? You know, and Kentucky Fried Chicken, Hublin. You know, I'm just.
And what about Congress? I mean, we know about Jesse Helms being the tobacco.
Well, he's the clown up front, designed to keep us from understanding the depths to which tobacco money really controls and penetrates. You don't, in terms of Congress, I haven't seen anybody yet who is willing to take on the, not just the cigarette industry, but the economic power that the industry in all of its aspects represents. But the fact is that 350,000 people a year are dying of smoking cigarettes. We've got untold numbers of babies being destroyed from birth by cigarettes. We've got tremendous social and economic costs, the equivalent of 3 747s crashing a day, you know, and it's an industry that is, in effect, been given license by the government to produce a product that's doing this. In other words, the government knows very well what the position of the European governments is on the issue of pesticides, because our tobacco farmers raise the tobacco that's made into cigarettes in Europe, because we have strong pesticide regulations in America. So the American government, the Department of Commerce, Department of Agriculture, help U.S. farmers, tobacco farmers, raise relatively pesticide-free tobacco to meet European standards, while at the same time allowing the cigarette industry to bring in third world tobacco for manufacture into cigarettes that Americans are smoking. And everybody along the way knows what's going on, but nobody's dealing with the issue. There's never been a single study of the effects of pesticides in tobacco or cigarette products by any of the major U.S. health research foundations.
Well,
not one.
How do you explain this? I mean, you told about the strange conditions of the scientific quote-unquote experiments using just pure tobacco rather than what people really smoke.
Right.
You would think there would be universities or independent health agencies or scientists who would do some more serious investigations. Why is this?
There's been one. Yeah. His name is Dr. Dietrich Hoffman. He was the head of Sloan Kettering's Cancer Research Institute. When Dr. Hoffman started doing research on the role of pesticide chemicals in oral cavity cancer in wet snuff chewers, he, within 12 months, for a variety of reasons, was no longer with Sloan Kettering, apparently had an extremely hard time finding any place to get his research published. He is now working full-time for the Dana Family Foundation in Valhalla, New York, of all places, in the American Health Foundation, and doing continuing to do research into the role of pesticides in oral cavity cancer. But all his research is being published in Europe and in Russia and China. He speaks all over the world, but he can't speak in the U.S. Nobody wants to hear him.
So there really is a conspiracy.
I don't know. You can't see the conspiracy. Right. All you can see is the results of, and you can infer there must be something going on.
Well, what you mentioned trying to get your information in the Nader publication. What about other print media or electronic media? Have you had any luck in getting in there?
No, I really haven't. I have a number of TV shows, commercial television people have heard about the research I've been doing, have approached me, have shot a lot of tape, edited it out, had visions of awards, I'm sure, for revealing this terrible, dark, murderous conspiracy, and then nothing has happened. When it's risen to the level of editorial on the station, and this happened with a station in Houston, and it's happened with several other stations. On the level of print media, it's very interesting. I'm a published author. I guess I've sold probably about 1 million books in my lifetime. And a million of my books have sold. I won't say I've sold them. But, and my, I have a good agent, a New York agent. He took my manuscript to the Frankfurt Book Fair where, and he got a call from World Health Organization in Geneva. They flew him down. And they said, if you can find a publisher who will publish this book anywhere, we will vet it for you. We'll provide the people to vet it to make sure there's no technical mistakes.
Vet
a manuscript, check it out. Make sure that there's nothing inaccurate in there that technically that can be seized upon as an excuse to criticize it. Right. They said that their World Health Organization is very aware of the problem. They consider it a major, major problem. But for various reasons, no government organization can address it either. So I was real pleased that you guys and Eve should check under the hoods of your car tonight, as I will.
Well, we can get you British publishers. I mean, we have contacts with a lot of presses in England that would probably be happy to publish.
Yeah, it seems to me it's a supreme irony here. We're talking about all the bad stuff that smoking tobacco, et cetera, or what people think is tobacco will do to you. And yet, on the other hand, I've read articles where it says that pure tobacco can be one of the greatest boons to mankind because in its role as food.
Well, there's been a lot of research in that area, and it's a couple of things to say that maybe will keep that from sounding so strange. Tobacco is an extremely high protein plant. In terms of plant proteins, it's more complete than corn or beans or anything else. And young tobacco, when it's just a green shoot, is extremely high in sugars as well. Animals love it. In tobacco country, you can't keep rabbit and deer, you know, and other grazing animals, cattle, out of your tobacco beds. So the notion that tobacco is just, if you treat tobacco as just another plant, then you can sort of get away from the idea that, well, wouldn't it kill you to eat it? Because it won't. You're talking about, Frank, is a series of experiments that have extracted protein in its pure form from tobacco and utilized it in feeding experiments. And it's been very successful. And there's a man in North Carolina, chairman of the crop science department there, who's been raising tobacco just for that purpose. He's been raising biomass. How much tobacco can I get on an acre? And he's achieved yields of 200 metric tons an acre a year of tobacco, very high in protein. And he's almost got enough protein out of an acre of tobacco that it's cost competitive with dried eggs, which are a major source of protein in animal feed and so forth.
Well, this goes back to a lot of Indian customs. Wasn't tobacco a major part of a whole lot of economies?
Yeah, it really was.
Different people all over the world.
It was considered a gift of the Great Spirit, one of the four great gifts. And it was, tobacco is a very powerful plant. It's got a very powerful plant spirit. The Hindu concept of Deva spirits in plants, the Deva spirit in tobacco is an extraordinary one. I've had Indian tobacco plants that I've grown that I've cut off at the soil line when they were blooming in the fall, and then I've hung them upside down in a dark basement without water, dry atmosphere, for 6 months, and come into the basement and they'd be turned up at the tip and blooming. Mm, and great. The seeds I was growing were out of a grave that was 800 years old. And I got 50% germination. So it's a remarkable plant in a lot of respects.
But it's one that's been severely abused by the cigarette industry.
Exactly.
That mixes all these chemicals and pesticides and synthetics in there. But what can be done about this? There have been some product liability suits. People have sued the tobacco companies because they claimed it had killed their relatives from cancer or whatever. What has been the fate of that, and how do you see these cases?
It's really been sad because over 300 product liability cases have been tried, have come to trial and gone through trial in the past approximately 10 years. And every single one has been won by the tobacco companies. I am not a legal scholar, but it seems to me from looking at the cases, and I've read as many of them as I could get a hold of, none of the trial testimony concerned raising the kinds of issues that I've brought out in this research, which would be really important if you were wanting to establish the company's liability for producing an unreasonably dangerous product. Most testimony is concentrated on one line, which is, this industry is manufacturing products that contain an addictive material, and my client got addicted to using these harmful products, and since he couldn't stop, the harmfulness of the product harmed my client and therefore the company's liable. And that line doesn't wash as far as product liability law goes. What you have to be able to do is you have to be able to prove that a manufacturer knowingly or unknowingly manufactured an unreasonably dangerous product and that you were in some way or another deprived of information which would have made a difference in your decision to use the product. And nobody's been able to prove that with regard to the tobacco industry. Pardon me. I see, I keep saying it. I'm an example of the fundamental subtle perception that keeps us from doing something about this industry. I keep saying the tobacco industry. They're not. They're not tobacco.
It's a cigarette.
It's the cigarette industry. The chemical industry. Stick industry.
Poison industry. It sounds like they know that there's these poisons.
Oh, they do.
And toxic material.
Toxic, carcinogenic, fetus damaging, all different forms of biological damage.
Well, ultimately, what would you propose doing about this? Obviously, you want to get information out to the public.
Yeah.
So in product liability suits, there can be judgments against the tobacco industries that will cause some problems for them. But what is your ultimate solution here?
Well, my ultimate solution, I would like to see something modeled on the Nuremberg trials. I think the cigarette industry is too multinational and too powerful to be effectively tried by any single government, just like the Nazi fascist movement was too international, you know, to be tried by any one government. I think that the industry's assets should be stripped from it, and I think that they should be distributed to those who've been injured and then should be put in a trust fund for those who, you know, who will continue to be injured over time by this. But I also think that that an awful lot of people have a right to smoke tobacco, and I think a lot of people would enjoy having a tobacco product that they could smoke. And there's certainly a great many farmers in this country and around the world who growing tobacco is what they know. Now, that tobacco doesn't wind up in the cigarettes, and what happens to it's another long story. But there's too many long stories involved in this whole issue. But I do think the industry needs to be disassembled, and I think that in its place, a new industry needs to be erected based on small farm production of a high-quality smoking product for people who want to smoke.
Bill, can you give us your address if people want to write to you for more information?
Sure. They can write, and I would appreciate a stamped self-addressed envelope, and if they want Xerox materials, you know, include a dollar, and I'll send them a package of Xerox materials. Just let me know that's what they want to do. It's 527 West Jefferson in Waxahachie, and I better spell that one. Waxahachie, Texas, 75165. And I get a lot of mail, and I really can't reply unless I get a stamped envelope. That's important.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
You folks can put out that cigarette now. Well, you still can.
We have time for two more news stories.
You know, every so often, every year, two or three, we get a news story on the media which say, hey, another study has shown that it's good for you to drink alcohol. You know, have a little nip or two when you come home and you'll live longer and blah, blah, blah.
I'll do that.
Yeah. These studies always say moderate drinking increases the heart-protecting HDL cholesterol level. But a recent British study of almost 8,000 men said that although this does happen, it's unimportant in affecting heart disease one way or the other. And it says risk factors like smoking or high blood pressure are judged to be a lot more relevant than drinking. And in the Journal of American Medical Association, this, by the way, is in Prevention Magazine of October 87, said that even moderate drinking was shown to conclusively, even if this was shown to reduce heart disease, the recommendations for alcohol consumption, which is horrible stuff, would be ill-advised because of the overall considerations of health concerns. For instance, they talk about breast cancer, for instance. Recent studies have shown that in studies of 97,000, more than 97,000 women, that those who drank just moderate amount of alcohol had a greater risk of breast cancer than women who didn't drink. And the risk for stroke was more than double, even for light drinkers, than for those who had less than, just one drink a day, or just people didn't do any at all. So this can even be worse, alcohol can for you, if people are taking sedatives, tranquilizers, painkillers, or over-the-counter medications. But, of course, that's a legal drug. You can say yes to that.
I have a story from the Utney Reader, the September-October issue, and it's titled, How Fresh Are Fresh Fruits and Vegetables? I know we all try and get our roughage, eat our salads and our fruits, and it may not be doing all that much good for you, friends. According to this article, they borrow a lot from Harrowsmith magazine. Most produce available in North America during the winter months is decidedly not fresh. And considering the amount of pesticides and other chemicals put on it, it's probably not very safe either. According to a U.S. Department of Defense report, most food in the United States travels 1,300 miles before it's eaten. And fresh fruit, as a lot of us know, loses much of its nutritional value as soon as it's picked. It starts losing it. Vitamins C and A, for instance, which are very volatile, are good examples. One study showed that fresh broccoli loses 19% of its vitamin C in one day and 34% in the second day. And that came from Harrowsmith. One University of California Davis food scientist went out and actually tested some grocery store Brussels sprouts and cabbage, which are normally good sources of vitamin C, and he was unable to find any measurable amounts of the vitamin in the food. Now, more frightening than this, as the article says, are the chemicals that are sprayed on the plants as they grow. Pesticide contamination may be responsible for as many as 20,000 cancer cases, according to a National Academy of Sciences study. The worst classification of poisons used would be the fungicides. They're particularly dangerous, and they're used mostly in commercially raised produce grown in Florida and Mexico. It's so humid, they tend to sprout all these creatures. Mm-hmm. According to the Harrowsmith article, quote, many fresh fruit and vegetable crops in Florida are sprayed 20 or more times a year with five or more active ingredients. And now, if that weren't enough, then you also have to worry about the waxy coating that you often find. You've got them on your bell peppers, your cucumbers, etc. Well, many of these, now listen closely, you vegetarians, many of these waxes are made from petroleum products and animal fat. So you may think that you're eating a vegetarian dinner, but you may be scarfing down some animal fat while you're at it. Now, they do this, of course, to increase shelf life and reduce moisture loss. Now, you homemakers, take note here. In order to get this wax off your cucumbers, you've got to wash the cucumber with detergent. It's not good enough just to wash it off with water. Another problem, the article says, is that the regulation of all these different pesticides and waxes and et cetera lags far behind the introduction of new chemicals. Every year we have a whole bunch of new ones introduced. Well, the FDA gets around to testing two or three per year. The recommendation of the article in the Utney Reader, they say, buy in-season produce grown organically and close to home. Or, as we do around in these parts, grow your own.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Goodbye.